From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. Trumpeter Red Rodney recently saw his early life dramatized in Clint Eastwood's movie Bird. On today's Fresh Air, Rodney tells us what it was really like to play in Charlie Parker's band. Also, we meet writer Hetty Jones. Her new memoir was hailed by Russell Banks as possibly the best account of 1950s and 60s New York bohemianism. Rock historian Ed Ward continues his retrospective on surf music. And world music critic Milo Miles wonders about the future of world music. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. Order is gradually returning to Romania's capital as thousands of pro-government coal miners hand control of central Bucharest over to the civil and military police. While the prime minister condemned the miners' beatings of government critics, President-elect Iliescu thanked the men and gave them a warm send-off. Catherine Hunt has this report from Bucharest.
Traffic is flowing through the heart of Bucharest, where only hours ago hundreds of coal-blackened miners returned after a brief absence. For several hours, they resumed their skull-bashing manhunt for suspected government critics. But the primitive violence encouraged by the former communist leader, Ion Iliescu, who had summoned the miners to suppress his opposition, had created a huge shockwave throughout the world. Across town, Prime Minister Petre Roman tried to explain the government's way out of the scandal to the foreign press, denying that the government sat back while the miners rampaged through town. And he blamed the foreign press for misinformation. Meanwhile, Iliescu thanked the departing miners and wished them good health. For National Public Radio, this is Kathleen Hunt in Bucharest.
Communities along the Texas coastline are bracing to deal with oil slicks and tar balls from the tanker Megaborg. Crude oil is reported to be within 25 miles of the shore. Officials say that water currents and light winds could bring the oil to land after Sunday. Texas state officials have sprayed oil-eating microbes on the oil sheens trailing from the vessel. It's the first time the microbes have been used on oil in open water, but if it works, the bacteria could render the oil harmless within 2 to 5 days. Federal law enforcement officials say they've arrested more than 160 members of two Los Angeles-based gangs. NPR's Celeste Wesson reports from Los Angeles on a nationwide anti-drug sweep that began yesterday.
The Bureau of Alcohol, Tobacco, and Firearms today announced the first national roundup of crack-dealing Crips and Bloods gang members. They made arrests in 11 states, including Oregon, Oklahoma, and Louisiana, as well as California. Local sweeps against the gangs often jail members for only a day, but spokeswoman April Freud says the Bureau hopes these arrests will do more than simply intimidate.
The difference is that we're not getting these people and getting them back out on the street as soon as we're picking them up. We're looking to significantly put them away and have an impact that way.
For the first time in a gang drug sweep, the Bureau is using tough federal drug laws passed 2 years ago. For example, possessing a firearm during a drug crime now carries a minimum 5-year sentence. Another law gives those with 3 prior felonies at least 15 years behind bars. I'm Celeste Wesson in Los Angeles.
Prices on Wall Street edged up to a new closing high today, boosted by favorable economic statistics from the government. The Dow Jones Industrial Average gained 8 points to close at a record 2,935.89. Declines led advances by a margin of 4-3 in heavy trading. This is NPR News. 3 major federal workers' unions are calling on Congress to override President Bush's veto of a bill that would ease restrictions on political activity by federal employees. The president said the measure would lead to the repoliticization of the civil service. He said that Congress's efforts to amend the 1939 Hatch Act would encourage partisan political campaigning on the part of federal workers. James Pierce, president of the National Federation of Federal Employees, called the veto a bitter disappointment. He called on members of Congress to vote to override it. Another hitch is developed in the plan to solve Canada's constitutional crisis. One of the provinces that must ratify a constitutional amendment before June 23rd is being prevented from doing so by a single member of that province's assembly. Richard Reynolds has more.
Manitoba is one of 2 provinces that still must approve the Meech Lake Accord before June 23rd. The accord is a constitutional amendment that grants French-speaking Quebec province special status. The amendment was set to expire on the 23rd, but a last-minute compromise deal struck last Saturday was supposed to save the accord. However, two provinces were left with just 2 weeks in which to have their legislatures ratify the amendment. In Manitoba, it now appears that isn't enough time. Elijah Harper, a native Indian member of the Assembly, is using various procedural tactics to hold up the process. So far, the government there has been unable to even introduce a resolution that would see the accord ratified, and will be unable to do so until at least Monday. The member is upset that the accord grants special status to Quebec, but not to Canada's native people. For National Public Radio, I'm Richard Reynolds.
At least 16 people are reported dead in the Ohio River town of Shadyside after a flash flood swept away cars, destroyed homes, and left dozens of people missing. Witnesses said thunderstorms sent a wall of water sweeping through Shadyside last night, damaging about 35 buildings. I'm Corey Flintoff, NPR News.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross, and my guest is trumpeter Red Rodney. Summertime is jazz festival time, and the Mellon Jazz Festival is underway in Philadelphia. Trumpeter Red Rodney is returning to his hometown as the festival's honoree. Rodney went on the road when he was still a teenager and played in the bands of Claude Thornhill, Gene Krupa, and Woody Herman. In 1949, he ended up in the place just about every young jazz musician wanted to be, Charlie Parker's band. Parker hired him to replace Miles Davis. But after Rodney left the band, his jazz career floundered, in part due to a drug habit. But he made a comeback in the 1970s, and he's been going strong ever since. Red Rodney is one of the musicians who was portrayed in the film Bird, Clint Eastwood's movie about Charlie Parker. Parker was played by Forrest Whitaker, Rodney by Michael Zellniger. In the movie, Rodney first meets Parker in an alley in back of a club.
Have we met?
No, sir. My name's Rodney.
You play Rodney?
Yeah, I'm with Krupa.
Do you play?
Trumpet.
Oh. And you came here to see Dizzy play?
I took the job touring with Krupa instead of staying in Philadelphia because the tour came to L.A. and I knew you were going to be here. Yeah, I came to hear you.
Now, a lot of people assume that they know you from having seen the movie Bird. How accurate a description of you was in the movie?
It was pretty accurate. Of course, some things they took licenses with. I didn't meet him in the back alley of Billy Berg's. I knew him 2 years before.
Parker, Charlie Parker.
Yeah. There was a hotel room scene which never happened. But aside from that, the wedding and the albino red bit in the south, that was true. The sort of friendliness that we had, he was sort of like an older brother. That was true. I think that came across. And I think the young man that portrayed me did very well.
Did you like the movie?
I was disappointed that they didn't show Charlie Parker like what he really did. It was a Charlie and Chan Parker. They made it a Hollywood love story, as they always do. Hollywood never gets it right. I think Clint Eastwood was given some bad advice and took it. I would have liked to have seen them show Charlie Parker as the great genius of modern music, modern jazz. And that could have been another Amadeus if they had done it that way.
Now, you started off playing in big bands. How did you first hear Bob and start playing it yourself?
Well, I had already been with a lot of the name bands because the war was on and all of the good trumpet players were drafted. And I was working in the house band of Atlantic City Steel Pier when all those bands came in, minus one or two trumpets. So they needed people like me. I got a little bit of experience there. Then I went with the Elliot Lawrence Orchestra, who was at WCAU, the radio station band. And that's when I first started listening to Dizzy Gillespie and Charlie Parker and hearing this whole new thing. And I was young enough to embrace it. I hadn't had any jazz history or traditions. My whole thing was Harry James and the big bands. And I remember Dizzy took me up to New York one Sunday, sat me in the middle of the Three Deuces and to hear his band. And I heard Charlie Parker. It was like a religious experience. I was completely overwhelmed. I remember leaving that place 4 o'clock in the morning and walking around like I didn't know what to do, where to go, how to think, but I knew what I wanted to do for the rest of my life. That's how powerful that affected me.
Well, Charlie Parker eventually hired you to replace Miles Davis. Did you feel prepared for that?
Not really. No, I told him, too. I told him I really wasn't ready for that. And he said, well, let me be the judge of that. He said, I know a good trumpet player when I hear one, and I think you are ready, and you'll be more ready once you come. And, of course, I grabbed it. I often say that was like going to college and graduate school, the 3.5 years I played with him.
Did Parker take you under his wing in addition to taking you into his band?
Well, I don't know about that. We were very friendly even before that. And, of course, we became more friendly when I was working for him. I was thrilled that a man like that could like me. I don't think I liked myself very much, but I was really thrilled that he did. And I guess you might say he took me under his wing a little bit, yeah. Of course, when he saw that I was trying to emulate him, he protested violently.
Emulate him in which way?
Well, in his drug use. And, he got very, very upset, and of course he didn't like it at all.
Do you think one of the reasons why he hired you was that you weren't using?
I don't think he thought of that. No, I don't think so. But I know it would have been, it would have been more difficult if I were. I don't think he would have wanted to be involved with that. It was enough for him rather than to have somebody else messing around like that.
Did you start using heroin as a way to emulate him? Is that what it was about?
Yes, I was very immature, and I kept looking and looking and saying, oh, my God, if I cross that line, could I possibly play like that? Curiosity killed the cat, you know, and pretty soon you wind up with a little habit. You don't play any better. In fact, you don't really live up to your potential because you have to be healthy to play well. And there it is. It took me years to get away from it.
Mm-hmm. What did Parker do to try to discourage you? Anything? Discourage you from using?
Well, many things. He threatened to fire me every day. he let me know in no uncertain terms how terrible a thing it was and how he couldn't handle it, what made me think that I could. Well, it turned out that it killed one of our greatest musical giants at the age of 34. And the young kid that was there, who was able to get straight, is now 63 years old and fairly successful. So there's the paradox.
Mm-hmm. Trumpeter Red Rodney is my guest. One of the celebrated stories in jazz lore is a story that was also recounted in the movie Bird, and that's the story of how during one of your tours through the South with Charlie Parker, he knew that an integrated band wouldn't go over well in the segregated South, that there were places you wouldn't be allowed to play. So he had the band advertised as Charlie Parker with albino red, so you were passed off as a black albino. This is a true story, right?
Yes, it is. We didn't fool anybody.
Uh-huh.
Everybody was very nice, and he had me sing a blues, and like the kid in the movie did. I think I sang better than that, though.
So. Is the story true that you ended up moving to a white hotel, and Parker said, I'll come with you, you could call me your valet?
Yeah, and they didn't show that in the movie. They should have, because that was hilarious. It would have been much better than the story they put in there in a hotel where he asked me to kick him in his rear end, and that never happened.
So tell me the valet story.
Well, after about a week or 10 days, we were in Atlanta, and I saw this big, beautiful hotel, and I said, you know, I'm going to go check in there. I'm going to take a bath. I'm sorry, but I'm doing this. He says, that's a good idea, and I can go with you as your valet. And I thought he was crazy, but he knew the South. If any white man at that time would register and say, John Jones and valet, they would not question it, and they'd give the valet a room along with him. And that's what happened. I remember him trying to send me downstairs to get cigarettes and newspaper. I said, no, you got to go down. You're the valet.
Let me play something that you recorded with Parker. Let's hear Parker's composition, Blues for Alice. And would you like to say anything about your memories of this recording session?
Well, that particular session, I was playing in the Jewish Alps, the Catskill Mountains. And all of a sudden, I got a phone call. Well, I'm in the swimming pool, and he said, you better get down here quickly. Norman Granz is doing a record date with us. And told me the studio, and I said, I'll be right down. Well, it took three, four hours to get there. But I made it, and that was it. That was the Blues for Alice Swedish Schnapps date. I think it's called Swedish Schnapps, the album. At least originally it was.
Uh-huh. So this is Charlie Parker with Red Rodney on trumpet, John Lewis at the piano, Ray Brown on bass, Kenny Clark drums. I guess Red Rodney on trumpet, and that recording of Blues for Alice, recorded with Charlie Parker and Red Rodney. Was it frustrating for you that during part of the period that you were with Parker, he was recording a lot of records with strings, which would mean that he wouldn't be recording featuring you in the small group?
Oh, it was quite frustrating. I remember I didn't know what I was going to do. I saw the handwriting on the wall that he was working more and more with strings. He tried to keep me on. It just wasn't enough money to have six or seven strings and another trumpet player. And I left and went back to Philadelphia and started working immediately. So that was okay.
What kind of work were you doing when you got back to Philadelphia?
Well, I did a lot of jazz work at first. You know, and then it wasn't so much happening at that time. So I started doing club dates, weddings, bar mitzvahs, and whatever.
That must have been very frustrating.
Very.
I mean, what kind of music would you have to play when you played bar mitzvahs?
Well, you played the standard tunes, and you played the pop tunes of the day, the Broadway show tunes. It was very good for you. Today, I go to a lot of affairs because my wife's in business, and there's a lot of affairs in that particular business. I see young jazz musicians playing in those bands, and so they make it sound much better. When I played in them, they were very corny, very society-oriented, the two-beat step, the two-step dancing with your elbows, you know, the Lester Landenmeyer Davis type.
Mm-hmm.
But it did teach me a lot, and it gave me a big repertoire for standard tunes. So you learn whatever you do, really.
Do you get a lot of use out of Hava Nagila?
Oh, yeah, but that's only the commercial one. There's a lot of other inside ones that are very good.
Uh-huh.
And when I played concerts in Israel, they flipped out that I knew all that music over there.
Oh, really?
Sure. Because I knew the real valid Hebrew music. I knew the Hasidic music. I knew the Romanian music. And they freaked out that a jazz artist would know all of that.
Huh. Let's take a short break, and then we'll talk some more. And my guest is trumpeter Red Rodney. And he's the musician of honor in this year's Mellon Jazz Festival in Philadelphia. Philadelphia is his hometown. This is Fresh Air.
Fresh Air is produced live at WHYY in Philadelphia and distributed by National Public Radio.
Trumpeter Red Rodney is my guest. You were telling us before that one of the reasons why you started using heroin was in the hopes that you'd play better, like Parker, who was a user, played so well, but that it didn't help your music, and as a matter of fact, it hurt your music and got you further away from it. You did this incredible scam to make money to support your habit, and I think this was in the 1950s where you impersonated a general and forged army checks.
Well, I did a lot of incredible things. I was a very good improviser. But you know something? To relate to that today is like I've become a virgin with white gloves. I can't even relate to that same person. Yeah, you know, a lot of the junkies in my day went out and they stole. The musicians that were junkies stole other guys' horns and this and that. I figured that if I were going to have to do that, I would either beat the banks or beat the government. So I did, and I paid for it. And I came out a much better person. That's all long behind me. You know, and I'm not going to discuss that because it's coming out in a book very soon, and Clint Eastwood might make a movie out of it. So
Oh, really?
We won't discuss that here.
Has he been talking to you about making a movie about your life?
Well, he's been talking to me about taking a first option on this book and the screenplay that we're almost finished with right now.
And the book is what, an autobiography?
Yeah.
Trumpeter Red Rodney is my guest. You spent a good part of the 1960s in showbiz, playing in Vegas bands. Why did you end up leaving jazz and going to Vegas?
Well, I had children. I was straightening my life out.
Mm-hmm.
And I, Vegas, you made a good living. You played in the hotel showroom orchestras. You worked 3 hours a day and you made $600-$800 a week, which is a very good salary, especially for then. The only unfortunate thing is there's no jazz at all. It was strictly showbiz. And eventually my jazz roots had to catch up to me. When my kids grew and left and went out on their own, I came right back to New York and came right back into jazz. And I've been very happy ever since.
What kind of shows did you play for in Vegas?
Well, I worked in the Flamingo for many years and then the Hilton. I played Frank Sinatra. I played Tom Jones. I played so many. A lot of the big name stars. I played French Reviews at another hotel there. And all things that you really don't like doing. But the living out there is very good if you're not a gambler. Living in the desert was beautiful. It's a nice place to retire to, really. It's very inexpensive. The taxes are very low. However, there's no jazz. And there probably never will be when, you know, the people that go there for the gambling and a big extravaganza, the Hollywood-type shows. These people listen to music with their feet instead of their ears.
When you decided to go back to New York and get back into jazz, how did you start?
I went with George Wein. He called me, and it was 1974, and took me to Europe on a tribute to Charlie Parker, the musical life of Charlie Parker. I did that tour. When that tour was finished, I stayed there and lived in Copenhagen for about almost 2 years. I lived in Copenhagen, but I worked all over Europe, and that got me back into the jazz market. And living in Copenhagen was very nice, and of course there's lots of work in Europe for an American jazz musician of some standing. However, I no longer had to be away from America, and I missed it terribly. I really wanted to come back. This is my home, and I love it. So I just picked up and came home.
You had some dental problems, I think, when you were getting back into jazz.
Yes, indeed.
Now, I think that this dates back to having your two front teeth knocked out by a cop, is that right?
Yes, in Philadelphia in 1952. That started it.
What happened? What was the story?
Oh, nothing. A guy came to examine me, so he said.
What do you mean?
Well, back then, if they caught somebody who was using drugs, they didn't have to catch him dirty. All they had to do was look at his arms and see if he had recent marks unconstitutional, against all civil liberties. And that was it. Now he placed me under arrest, and I didn't say a word. And he started beating the crap out of me. You know? You know, of course, he tried to say, oh, well, he tried to fight me back. Now, how's a little guy like me going to stand up to a big 6'3" or 6'4" animal? And that's what he was.
Was he trying to arrest you for using?
Yeah. Years later, he got arrested for selling drugs, too.
No kidding,
very
really?
Nice to know.
Huh.
Yeah. Many years later.
Was it hard for you to start playing jazz again? I mean, did you have to get back in the swing of things?
You have to get back a little bit, sure. You just can't pick up your horn and start doing it. That period in Europe was very good for me because I was working quite a bit. I was getting all my thoughts together. And when I got back to America, I was in good shape. I was better than I had ever been. In fact, my best years musically have been between the ages of 50 and 62. So I'm very lucky. Most men, in anything they do, when they reach 50, they start slipping a bit. I seem to have been shooting up and improving. I hope it continues for another 10 years or 20 years.
You'll be coming to Philadelphia to perform Monday night, and you're also the musician of honor at this year's Mellon Jazz Festival in Philadelphia. Do you still have family here?
Oh, lots of family, and they're all coming. I'm very friendly with my immediate cousins on my mother's side, and of course they'll all be there, and my sister and nieces and nephews. But all of a sudden, many cousins from my father's side have called that I haven't seen in 40 years. So I look forward to meeting them. I wouldn't recognize them if I saw them on the street, and they're coming. A lot of friends are coming. And you know something? I'm really thrilled to be honored by your hometown, and after all these years, perhaps they forgiven my earlier transgressions. I know I've forgiven them.
So do you do anything really mischievous anymore? I mean,
I told you, my wife calls me a virgin with white gloves.
Uh-huh.
I'm a very conservative, normal, straight-living person today. That's the way it should be. You know, after I straightened my life out, the jazz profession is very, very forgiving. As long as you can play, and as long as they see that you're okay, you're welcomed back like nothing ever happened. So I've been very lucky. And I would hope that the other people who straighten up become as lucky as I did.
Well, I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you.
Trumpeter Red Rodney. This is from his recent album, Red Snapper.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and Apple Computer, providing the Fresh Air staff the power to be their best. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. In the 1950s, Hetty Cohn was a young Jewish woman who longed for adventure and the literary life. She found it in Bohemian Greenwich Village, where she met and married the aspiring black poet Leroy Jones, later known as Amiri Baraka. Coming up, we talk about her memoir, A Portrait of the Marriage, and its breakup. Also, rock historian Ed Ward remembers when surf music caught on in even the most landlocked parts of America. And world music critic Milo Miles thinks about the state of world music now that it has its own chart in Billboard magazine. That's all coming up on Fresh Air.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Ann Taylor. In Washington, the Bush administration has announced plans to punish the new government of Romania to force it to call off what it calls vigilante violence against political dissidents. NPR's Richard Gonzalez reports.
State Department spokesman Richard Boucher called on the Iliescu government to clear all worker vigilantes from the streets and to pledge that they will not be allowed to return. He also called on the Romanian government to guarantee the public safety of members of all political parties and dissidents and to engage in a dialogue with opposition parties.
Until the democratic process is restored, the United States has decided to withhold all non-humanitarian economic support assistance that Romania might be eligible for.
However, Boucher was unable to say how much money could be withheld. The State Department has dispatched the U.S. Ambassador to Romania, Alan Green, to convey the administration's concerns. I'm Richard Gonzalez in Washington.
In Moscow, the Soviet Union announced today that it is easing an economic blockade of Lithuania and is ready for talks with the breakaway Baltic Republic over its bid for independence. Earlier this week, the Prime Minister of Lithuania said that Soviet officials had agreed to supply more natural gas and said that her parliament would consider freezing implementation of its declaration of independence, as demanded by Moscow, in order to get talks started. Cleanup crews have released oil-eating microbes into the Gulf of Mexico in an effort to stop the spread of crude oil from the crippled oil tanker, Megaboard. Kathy Law reports that this is the first time the experimental treatment is being used in open seas.
Researchers carried out the experiment in the Gulf of Mexico, where the Megaborg is still leaking oil, although it no longer appears to be burning. University of Texas professor Carl Oppenheimer developed the strain of bacteria used in the Megaborg test. He explains the process from a Coast Guard boat where the test took place.
There's a 55-gallon drum in the back, and we fill that with water, seawater, and add the powdered bacteria at the concentration that we've decided upon and some nutrients. And then these are sprayed out with a high-pressure nozzle.
Scientists hope to see significant results within 24 hours. For National Public Radio, I'm Kathy Lohr reporting.
U.S. officials have turned down a Soviet proposal to start talks this fall on cutting superpower short-range nuclear missiles. White House spokesman Marlon Fitzwater says that the Bush administration agrees with NATO that these talks should not be held until after an agreement is reached on cutting conventional forces in Europe. On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrials moved up over 7.5 points to close at a record high of 2,935.89, on volume of 205 million shares. This is National Public Radio News.
This is Fresh Air. In 1960, Southern California gave birth to the sound that celebrated life at the beach, surf music. Before long, the cry, "Surf's Up," was heard all over the country. In part two of his retrospective, rock historian Ed Ward remembers when surf music rode the big wave.
Me cynical, but I think that one reason surf music took off so slowly is that the powers that be couldn't quite figure out a way to sell it to teenagers who didn't live in California. As the Beach Boys had proved in the summer of 1962 with their hit recording of Surf and Safari, there was something to this surf stuff, but how would they sustain interest in it in places where it wasn't summer every day of the year? Well, first off, by having the Beach Boys start recording songs about cars, that other teenage phenomenon, even though 409, the B-side of Surf and Safari, barely even charted. The next gambit was a song with a proven airplay gimmick. Name every place you could think of.
Bushy blonde hair, serving USA. You'll catch him surfing at the
inside, outside USA.
Ventura County line,
inside, outside USA.
Santa Cruz and
Trinidad, inside, outside USA.
Australia's Caribbean,
inside, outside USA.
All over Manhattan,
inside, outside USA.
And down Bohini Way,
inside, outside.
Everybody's got surfing USA.
Ah, and did you catch those references to products? Baggies, Huarache sandals, Woodies, these were things you could buy. And as the summer of 63 got closer, they were getting bought. I have eyewitness accounts of guys in baggies, surfboards strapped to the roofs of their Woodies, driving in freeway circles in such landlocked cities as Dayton, Ohio and Lubbock, Texas. Everybody was surfing USA. And the proof was that that record hit the number 3 position in March 1963. By June, the surf sound was established. So much so that Brian Wilson of the Beach Boys didn't mind helping out a veteran L.A. teen act, Jan and Dean, who were trying to make the transition to the new sound. He co-wrote a song with Jan Berry, went into the studio with them, and helped them with the arrangement and vocals on their 1963 summer smash, Surf City.
Two girls for every
Then Wilson sat and watched it do what no Beach Boys song had yet done, go to the very top of the charts. Surf City, though, was the surf sound. Everybody knew what that was that summer. It was those harmonies and instrumentals like the one that sat just below Surf City on the charts, performed by the Surfaris, Wipeout. Surf music was wild, it was crazy, it was teenage, and that's why the Beach Boys were very smart to break completely with the stereotype of surf music, if not its teen appeal, when they came out with their summer of 63 surf single. Beach Boys, perhaps sensing that the surf fad was about to go bust, never released another single about surfing again, moving on to just Cars and Girls for future releases. Not that surf music disappeared entirely, just that it once again reverted to novelty status on the radio nationally.
Oh, well, everybody's heard about the bird. Bird, bird, bird. The bird's a winner. Well, the bird, bird, bird. Bird is a winner. Well, the bird, bird, bird. Well, the bird is a winner. Well, the bird, bird, bird. The bird's a winner. Well, the bird, bird, bird. Well, the bird is a winner. Well, the bird, bird. The bird's a winner. Well, the bird.
The Trash Men's Surf and Bird, a blatant ripoff of the Rivingtons' hit The Bird is the Word earlier in the year, was the sort of thing surf music had become for most people, although various instrumentals by Dick Dale, the Ravels, and the Marquettes continued to chart in California. By the end of 1963, the Beatles were planning to give surf music a run for its money, and the Beach Boys, stuck with a silly name that would stigmatize them as pop music got more serious, were exploring what they could do with their sound.
There's a world where I
3 weeks after this record came out, President Kennedy was shot, and somehow, by the time the next summer came around, surf music had become uncool, something to be ashamed of. That was silly, of course. What it actually had been was American rock and roll's last burst of innocence.
Ed Ward is co-author of Rock of Ages, The Rolling Stone History of Rock and Roll. This is Fresh Air. Hetty Cohn met Leroy Jones in 1957. She was a white bohemian working on a small jazz magazine. He was a black writer, soon to establish an international reputation for his poems and plays. Cohn and Jones married, had two children, and published a literary journal together from their kitchen table. But a few years after Hetty Cohn became Hetty Jones, Leroy Jones became Amiri Baraka, a name that better fit his new identity as a black revolutionary. The marriage ended in 1964. Hetty Jones raised their two children and wrote several books for adolescents. Her new book is a memoir called How I Became Hetty Jones. Baraka published his memoir, The Autobiography of Leroy Jones, in 1984. I asked Hetty Jones what it was like to read about herself in his book.
It was a strange experience, let's put it like that, since he changed my name in the book and he purported to write a factual book, but indeed he changed the names of myself and a number of other people who were central to that whole movement or scene or whatever you want to call it in the arts. And so finding myself referred to as Nellie in his book was a strange experience. And of course, when someone doesn't set out particularly to write the story of one person, there are, of course, lapses. And I don't think he set out to write a story of a marriage or a particular... He had a different point of view, let's put it that way. And so for me, it was an odd experience.
Do you know why he changed your name from Hetty to Nellie in his autobiography?
Nope. I guess you'll have to ask him.
Okay. In your memoir, you write about the day that you and Leroy Jones married, and you write, "I was the happiest and best-loved woman in New York." Now, I went back to Amiri Baraka's autobiography, and he writes about the relationship. "We seemed to get on smoothly enough, though there was no great passion. We got married, and still there was no great passion." And I was wondering what you think about hearing this both ways. You know what I mean? Like hearing this kind of aloofness in Baraka's book and then, you know, thinking about the way you experienced it. Do you think that he was being a revisionist about his own emotions or that you both experienced the thing very, very differently?
Well, I think maybe the revisionist might be the word to describe that, because, well, it was a long time, and everyone has a right to be a revisionist, I suppose. Well, people do it all the time. I mean, people rewrite history all the time in the light of what they know later. But I think that if you read the poems that he wrote, I think they explain how he felt then much more than the book that he wrote 20 years later describes how he felt then. You can't write such beautiful poems without feeling a little passion, and it didn't seem that way at the time. We had a very non-argumentative kind of marriage. We didn't have loud fights and disagreements. We didn't get on like that. We got on very peacefully, and we had a lot of fun.
Mm-hmm. Your husband was having affairs with other women. Did you feel it would have been too middle class to call him on that? Did you feel that somehow you had to accept it?
Well, No, I didn't feel that I had to accept it. I just got a little tired of dealing with it, and my way of dealing with it wasn't to insist, although I did, if you recall from reading the book, I did insist once that he was making a fool of himself. I didn't say get out. I just told him that he was really looking awkward, and he was looking like that stud, the stereotypical stud, and I thought that he should look at himself for that reason. But if you hook up with a man who's a womanizer, I think you, or at that time, you have some choices. You can call him on it and tell him that he's got to stop and pay a great deal of attention to it, or you can just say, okay, this is what he's doing. But if I follow his every movement, then I have much less time to follow the movements of my own life. And we did have the kind of marriage in which we were mutually interdependent, but I always felt that I was an independent person. And so the more time I spent looking after his affairs and trying to find out who he was with or trying to trace him down, the less time there would have been for me to conduct my own life. And I was really trying to do that.
After you were married, Leroy Jones's writing started becoming more militant and more separatist. And you say that reviewers would always point out that he had a white wife. Now, how is that supposed to be interpreted? Was that supposed to somehow make him a hypocrite?
Right, exactly. You can't, you know, as they say, talk black and sleep white. And when it got really bad, there were people who would call up and say, you're laying with the devil. I think this is a narrow attitude on the part of many people who feel that black militancy is a thing unto itself that white people cannot, in a way, lend themselves to or participate in some way. I think we have to understand, especially on the part of a white person who is in a marriage to a black person and who has become the parent of black children, that there's no going back. You can't be thought of as simply a white person who is, quote, on the other side. There are many many colors of black, and in a way, we have to understand that in the world to come, there are going to be many colors of white. There are ways to look at a white person and not see white, and look at a black person and not see race. We have to learn, I think, in this country to begin to see ourselves as American. That's my goal, anyway, if that answers the question.
Well, yeah, and as a matter of fact, I want to get back to that in a minute. I just want to get back to what we were talking about, though, with the reviews that mentioned, you know, that Jones is married to a white woman. How did he take that? Did he start to resent you when it was implied that somehow he was being hypocritical because he was married to you?
Well, of course, it sets up an imbalance. You know, you have to explain yourself all the time, and that was he wasn't taken on his literary merit or even for what he said. He was taken on his personal life. That is, his work came down to his domestic affairs. And any person who writes is going to resent that a little bit.
You have two children.
That's right.
Both Leroy Jones and Mary Baraka is the father of both. And you had basically talked about before you had children that in an interracial marriage, a child of an interracial marriage is always going to be seen as black.
Mm-hmm.
So when you divorced, you were a white woman with two children who would be seen by the world as black. This was in a time of increasing black nationalism and separatism. Did you start to feel that you and therefore your children were going to be cut out of certain black circles that you had been a part of before?
Well, certainly it was a difficult time, and there's no denying that it was. But Leroy Jones and Mary Baraka's parents were very fond of their grandchildren. We'd always had a very good relationship, and I was estranged from my family. And so I really was far more a part of their family by that time. They did not repudiate the children. And when it came down to situations in which I knew my face was not welcome, I sent the children alone. There were other situations in which the children appeared without me, taken to certain events by Baraka and his second family, or taken by other sympathetic black friends who knew the situation, knew the political polls at hand, and who saw that Kelly and Lisa Jones needed to establish their roots in the black community and establish themselves as young black people who were going to always be part of a black revolutionary movement. And so they needed to, no matter who their mother was, they needed to be in on certain things, and so they were taken along. And I understood, I mean, you have to have one thing, when you enter into a marriage like this, and when if a person decides to have black children, you got to realize that there are going to be risks involved. There are going to be things that may be difficult, more difficult than an ordinary marriage where this issue doesn't arise. And so if you want to consider that self-sacrifice, then I suppose it might be. But I just did what I had to do.
You talked before about there being different shades of white. And how does that apply to you as someone who has a mixed family?
Well, now that things have come around a little bit, you know, we went through that particular hard time that we just talked about, and then that thing sort of, there was a new wave of interracial bohemia in the later 70s, and I got to know a whole generation of young black and white and Asian people, and who established a multiracial and multicultural bohemia, and I do see myself as part of a multicultural, multiracial reality, which I really think is the reality of the world, and much more of what the America of the future will look like. And I've always been a person not to look at the past, but to look at the future.
Hetty Jones. Her memoir, How I Became Hetty Jones, is published by Doubleday. This is Fresh Air. Robert Siegel's with us. Robert, what's coming up on All Things Considered?
Well, we'll be hearing from reporter Kathleen Hunt in Bucharest, Romania today about the Romanian government's account of what's been happening there for the past couple of weeks. She calls it a grotesque attempt to rewrite history, as the prime minister says that the violence was really all the can all be blamed on prostitutes, black marketeers, and fascists in the capital. Meanwhile, the president of Romania gave a fond and grateful farewell to the miners who came in and were beating up people in the streets and ransacking the offices of political parties. Also, we'll hear about a new concerto for bass and orchestra. It's called Jack and the Beanstalk.
Thanks, Robert. That and more on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. Billboard is the unchallenged Bible of the music industry, and what it says about the business part of music is considered gospel. Now that Billboard has a world music chart, world music commentator Milo Miles wonders what kind of entity international pop has become.
When I discovered that Billboard put the world music chart under the New Age music chart as part of the top adult alternative albums section, I was stunned. This is an outrage, I fumed. It's placing the quick with the dead. New Age and world music audiences have nothing in common. Or do they? Well, in the Billboard universe, they do. Billboard is trusted in part because of its caution, and the world music chart concentrates on the most obvious mainstream retailers and radio stations that regularly deal in world music, the international sound you can buy in the malls. Well, music charts are about money, not art, but how those terms are defined and researched is up for grabs. Anyway, it's surprising how much the world music chart reflects the makeup of most other Billboard charts, including the Hot 100. First, there's items that don't make any sense at all. Why is reggae, like the album Now by Black Uhuru, considered world music? If reggae is world music, then so is British rock. Both are simply pop music from islands outside the United States with people who don't speak English the same way we do. Why are Beausoleil's album Live from the Left Coast and Ben Taverna King's Coyote Moon considered world music? Both of these performers are Americans. It might be because Beausoleil often sing in Cajun French, and Ben Taverna King has been known to warble in Spanish, but King's Coyote Moon is all instrumentals. Then you have disturbing entries that truly are top adult alternative albums, favorites of broad-minded baby boomers. Not that there's anything wretched about the Gypsy Kings or the Bulgarian Women's Choir. They just have very predictable appeal. The Gypsy Kings have a big streak of hyper-emotional schlock in their work. They cover Volare without a trace of irony. And the Bulgarian Women's Choir is blatantly gorgeous, filled with a sort of rich vocal swells that won't frighten anyone away. The world music chart does strike some sparks of confrontation, however. In the lower half of the numbers, but rising, is Thomas Mapfumo's Corruption. A number of songs on the album take aim at politicians in Mapfumo's Zimbabwe and shoot them down with lean, thorny dance rhythms. From the testimony of many retailers and distributors, it's plain that so far world music is indeed a sound for more or less well-off folks over 30. Not unlike New Age fans, but with, I hope, a more robust temperament. Even so, this demographic means that world music has no pop action behind it. If world music is going to take over the world in the way it deserves, some fireball performers, young, hungry, steeped in rhythm and able to overcome language barriers, are going to have to tear it away from New Age doldrums and storm up the Hot 100 with it. A Billboard chart confirms that world music has a place in the present, but as things stand, it might not have a very exciting future.
Milo Miles is a freelance journalist who writes about music for the New York Times and the Village Voice. Naomi Person produces our commentaries and reviews. Our interviews are produced by Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, and Joan Tuohy. Production assistance from Roberta Shurrock and Allison Dufty. I'm Terry Gross.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and from Talbots, retailers of women's classic clothing and accessories through stores and catalogs, 1-800-225-8200. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, we meet artist Dwayne Hansen. His life-size sculptures of tourists, shoppers, and people at work are often mistaken for the real thing. And TV critic David Bianculli reviews a new Siskel and Ebert special that looks at the future of the movies. I'm Terry Gross, and I hope you'll join us for the next Fresh Air.